Cassette 7, Side 2. He sits down on a chair near the doorway and reads aloud from them. Since 1989, he's been coming to ZL, and he's been getting antihypertensives. I saw him last in 1997, and he had malaria, and then it says, come back Thursday for a follow-up. He didn't come back. And oops, here we go. It says here, trouble standing up. And his son had come for medicine for his blood pressure. Farmer kneels on the dirt floor and takes the man's pulse and blood pressure, then puts on a stethoscope and listens to his chest for a while. Cocks crow outside. The air inside is still and hot, vibrating with flies. The old man says he felt a little pain at the center of his chest and afterward weakness in his legs. Farmer says to me, I know what I'm going to do. Get his blood pressure down to normal, then get him two Canadian crutches. I think he probably had a stroke, but he should be able to recover, is what I'm saying. His deficit is minimal. So I have to get somebody to help me get the Canadian crutches here. To get his blood pressure just right would be easy at the Brigham. It's not easy here. And how do we check and make sure he's doing his physical therapy? The old man's wife says she wants her blood pressure checked, too. Kneeling beside her, Farmer says in English, she's 62, going on 100. Adding, as if to himself, we are far from the Brigham, my friend. The woman's pressure is high, too, he says. I, meanwhile, am trying to think of what Farmer said to me a year ago about the profound difference between being bedridden in a nice house outside Boston and mat-ridden in a hut like this. But I can't stop thinking at the same time about the little pain that has been flitting around behind my left nipple, on and off, ever since that first cliff climb. Finally, I tell Farmer about the pain. Then I apologize, and he says, don't be silly. Tell me more about it. He asks me a dozen questions, and says he thinks I just have heartburn. But if it gets worse, you have to tell me. You don't want to see Alcante that bad. Promise? Several small children have come to the doorway. They stand there, peering in. Farmer says to them, speaking of the sad-looking woman of the house, you love her a lot? Do you tell her? Don't lie to me now. The children giggle. The old woman smiles. Farmer nods toward a naked toddler in the doorway. Look at his toy. The child is sucking the thumb of one hand. In the other, he holds a piece of coarse hemp string. A rock is tied to the end of it. Rocks are us, says Farmer, and I laugh. I can't stop. Farmer starts laughing too, saying, now I'm going to have chest pain. God is going to strike me dead. He says that he's going to give me half a beta blocker just in case. And still, I can't stop laughing. God is going to strike me dead, he says again, for drinking more than my share of water, for not living humbly, for my bad sense of humor. It's your fault. I'm playing to my audience. But, I think, he hasn't drunk any water yet. He gives the couple their pills and instructions. Goodbyes are always long in Haiti. When we get outside, Farmer says, this was a bel coutna, a good cast of the net. We came to see Papa and got Grandma, too, just in time, before she got run over by a reindeer. I've heard him use the fishing metaphor many times. When a sick person is discovered by accident, he usually says he's made a lucky catch. As if Jean-Mi La Santé didn't have enough patients already. Is there a long way still to go? I ask as we walk on. Oh, yeah. This is a quarter of the way there. A quarter? Since the death of the boy John, I've been trying to form my question for Farmer about that case. I remember a remark he made to me a year ago in these hills. You should compare suffering. Which suffering is worse? It's called triage. The term comes from the 14th century French trier, to pick or cull, and was first used to describe the sorting of wool according to its quality. In modern medical usage, triage has two different meanings, nearly opposite. In situations where doctors and nurses and tools are limited, on battlefields, for instance, One performs triage by attending first to the severely wounded who have the best chance of survival. The aim is to save as many as possible. The others may have to die unattended. In the peacetime case, however, in well-staffed and well-stocked American emergency rooms, for example, triage isn't supposed to imply withholding care from anyone. Rather, it's identifying the patients in gravest danger and giving them priority. Farmer has constructed his life around this second kind of triage. What else is a preferential option for the poor in medicine? But Haiti more nearly resembles a battlefield than a place at peace. Walking behind him, I say there must always be situations here where the choice to do one necessary thing also means the choice not to do another. Not just to defer the other, but not to do it. All the time, he says. Throughout your whole career, you've had to face this, right? Yes. I do it every day. Do this instead of that. Every day, all day long. That's all I do, is not do things. So, I ask, what about the case of John? What about the $20,000 that PIH spent on the medevac flight to get him out of Haiti? Not long after John died, a PIHer, a relatively new one, said to me that she couldn't help thinking of all the things they could have done with that $20,000. What is his response to that? I don't mean this at all critically, I add, hurrying along behind him. Come on, he says over his shoulder. I'm not hypersensitive, but we've already discussed this so many times. I'm just failing to do a good job, or you're not convinced. Maybe I'll never convince you that the choices we make are good ones. I don't want to nettle him. For one thing, he's both my guide and my doctor for today. But I recognize his tone of voice. He's not really irritated. He's just delivering a preamble, warming up his argument. He continues, talking over his shoulder to me as we walk on. Let me say a couple of things about this particular case, if you like. One is, remember, of course, that John was referred to Boston as dying of a treatable tumor, a very rare tumor. He wasn't referred to Mass General before we knew what he had. So when he was referred, it was for free care because he had such a rare thing and it was treatable, and the predicted cure rate was 60% to 70%. All right. Good enough. That's what the decision was made on. And there was no way for us to find out that John didn't have locally invasive disease without metastases because it required a diagnostic test that we can't do here. So the other thing is, the bottom line is, why do we intervene as aggressively as we can with that kid and not with another? Because his mother brought him to us, and that's where he was, in our clinic. I wondered when Serena and Carol came to get him, if you'd have decided to bring him after all if you'd been there. He was so emaciated. The emaciation wouldn't have stopped me. If I'd seen him and seen how far he'd gone downhill, I wouldn't have stopped the process. Why? On what grounds? We didn't know until he got to Boston that the cancer had invaded his vertebrae. We climb another cliff, and I'm breathing too hard to speak. After a short pause, he says, I have to tell you, though, I'm a little troubled by these comments from the new PIHer, because I have to work with these people. The last thing I want to do is expend my energy trying to convince my own co-workers. Now I have to, of course. But I don't like it. The Haitians have a lot to say about inviting the wrong people into your midst, you know? I don't want to misrepresent it, I say. Your PIHer wasn't saying you shouldn't have brought John to Boston, only that it was a shame you had to spend so much, given what else you could do with 20 grand. Yeah, but there are so many ways of saying that, he replies. For example, why didn't the airplane company that makes money, the mercenaries, why didn't they pay for his flight? That's a way of saying it. Or how about this way? How about if I say, I have fought for my whole life, a long defeat? How about that? How about if I said, that's all it adds up to, is defeat? A long defeat. I have fought the long defeat and brought other people on to fight the long defeat, and I'm not going to stop because we keep losing. Now, I actually think sometimes we may win. I don't dislike victory, You and I have discussed this so many times. Sorry. No, no, I'm not complaining, he says. You know, people from our background, like you, like most PIHers, like me, we're used to being on a victory team. And actually, what we're really trying to do in PIH is to make common cause with the losers. Those are two very different things. We want to be on the winning team, but at the risk of turning our backs on the losers, no, it's not worth it. So you fight the long defeat. He pauses. How you feeling? Is that chest pain gone? I am overheated, but that little flitting pain hasn't come again. Farmer continues, and most of the time when people ask about triage, most of the time they're asking not with open hostility, but deep distrust of our answer. They already have the answer. And that, of course, is the energy-draining process. Because you understand that a substantial proportion of the questions are asked in a, you know, in a very, what's the word? With an animus? Yeah. He's silent as we scrabble down a hilly section of the trail. At the bottom, he resumes. The salary of a first-world doctor. How about that? Talk about all the money that could have been spent on other things. What about a doctor's salary? I laugh. I hadn't thought of that. Well, of course. See, the truly humble think of that before they say the other. I'm not truly humble. I'm trying to be humble. So let me ask you another question. What is it that makes people not think that? Why doesn't a young American doctor say, gee, my salary is 5 times what John's airplane ride cost, and I'm 29 or 30-some years old? If you say that stuff out loud, you sound like an asshole. Whereas, if you say the other stuff, you just sound thoughtful. Now, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with this picture? If you say, well, I just think how much could have been done with $20,000, you sound thoughtful, sensible, you know, reasonable, rational, someone you really want on your side. However, if you were to point out, but a young attending physician makes $100,000, not 20, and that's 5 times what it costs to try to save a boy's life, that just makes you sound like an asshole. Same world, same numbers, same figures, same currency. It's just, you know, I never have been able to figure it out. I mean, I figured it out, but I realize now it takes so much time to get to that point to explain it without offending someone. So what are you thinking? I like the line about the long defeat, I tell him. I would regard that as the basic stance of O for the P, he replies. I don't care if we lose. I'm going to try to do the right thing. But you're going to try to win. Of course. We're not, you know, masochistic. And then all the victories are gravy, you know? The other option is to be jaded because you've been fighting a defeat for 18 years and trying to stop it. At least save the elbow joint for Kenol, you know? He's referring to a current patient, a boy back in Kanj whose hand got caught in a sugarcane press. A low medieval device, Farmer called it, and ended up with gangrene. In the end, his arm had to be amputated above the elbow joint. After the operation, he said he wanted a radio. Farmer bought him one on his latest Miami day. Jean-Mi La Santé will send him to school. How's your chest? Farmer asks. It feels all right, in fact. But there is only one mouthful of water left in my jug, and Farmer has said he'd prefer that I not drink the unfiltered water Tijon is carrying. So, for the moment, I think I'd rather be thirsty. Farmer goes on. If we could identify losers like John and not waste our time and energy on them, then we'd be all good, as they say in the States, right? But the point of O for the P is that you never do that. You never risk that. Because before you turn your back on someone like John, you have to be really, really sure. And the more you learn about John's family, the more you realize that the whole family, they're basically extinct, right? He was the last kid. They're extinct. His mother's bloodline is just gone. It sounds Darwinian, but you know what I mean. Shit, man, how can you be an O for the P doc and be willing to take that risk without all the data you can get? Every patient is a sign. Every patient is a test. Like this guy we just saw. The guy's living in dirt. The guy who needs Canadian crutches? You realize how much shit I'd get for that? Canadian crutches in rural Haiti? Because they're not appropriate technology? Yeah. Now you can see the critiques revealed for what they are. But I have to limit the amount of time I put into explaining all that, or it just sucks your soul dry. If I spent all my time arguing, no, this man needs Canadian crutches and a roof and a floor. I mean, if you're only defensive, if you say, fuck you, man, I already built 1,000 houses in this country, how many have you built? That doesn't go anywhere either. But that's the very doctor they'd be criticizing, one who's already done his housing fellowship and his practicum in blah, blah, blah. If you spend all your time arguing about that stuff, defending yourself, you don't get your work done. It must mean something that Tijan doesn't talk about things like appropriate technology. We are walking, Farmer has said, through what used to be rebel territory during both Haiti's slave days and the years when the U.S. Marines occupied the country. It seems different from the areas near Kanj. The farmyards and even the hilltops look a little more fertile, a little less bereft of soil and trees, but the land is just as crowded. We have been trudging through deep country, far from anything that could even be called a road, and yet there's hardly been a moment when other people haven't been in sight or just around the next turn in the trail. We've forded one big river, pigs rooting in the banks, chunks of earth falling into the water, and irrationally, I felt as though I should catch the soil in my arms and put it back. I'm not sure how many hours we've been walking. It must be at least 4. We've crossed ridge after ridge, and we're still encountering the works of PIH. Some are inanimate, a school that Zami La Santé built out here in the mountains. But mostly, they're patients. I've lost count of their numbers, and we're still running into them. They are the fairly healthy-looking ones who say to Farmer in Creole, "Hi, my doc," or "How's my doc's little body today?" And patients who are works in progress. The most memorable for me is a girl whose neck and chest were burned some time ago. It looks as if the flesh on the lower part of her face had melted and then hardened into a beard of skin. The strands of the beard attaching her jaw and chin to her chest and shoulders more and more tightly as she's grown. Never mind the grotesque scarring. In another year or so, her mouth will be pulled permanently open, unless she gets to a plastic surgeon. Farmer has been trying to arrange the necessary operations in the United States. "It's a boîte," he says. "We getting close to Cass?" I ask. "Well, you don't want to know just yet." He smiles. He stops and points to a hilltop in the distance. "Wait till we get over that ridge. Then I'll break it to you. Khyber Pass, Ruby Ridge. I'm sorry, Lord of the Rings, Redhorn Pass. Smell this. It's Campeche. I drank my last sip of water some time ago, and I'm feeling slightly dizzy as we continue on. My mouth has grown so dry that I croak when I try to speak. Farmer has noticed. He starts calling out, "Do you have oranges?" at every farmyard we pass. I end up sitting with my back against a tree, devouring 6 oranges, one right after the other. And when we finally reach Cass, a brown and dusty, dirt street market town, constructed of wood and corrugated metal, Farmer feeds me cokes. "I can't tell you how much better I feel." "Hydration," he says. Zami La Santé's local health worker, a barefoot woman in a dress, shows us the way to Alcante's house. Farmer waited for her to find us. He didn't ask the strangers in Cass for directions. Because they're hats, there would be no shortage of wrong answers. You learn that in year 3 or 4. Another half hour's walk, and we arrive at the farm, which consists of a stand of millet, a cook shack with a 3 rocks fireplace, and a hut made of what is known as wattle and daub, that is, dried mud and sticks. The roof is old banana bark, patched all over with rags. "Alcante," says Farmer, "I'm happy to see you."
"And I'm delighted to see you," says the shiny little boy.
He calls to his sisters emerging from the hut.
"Are there any more chairs here? We need more chairs."
"The little social director," Farmer says to me.
He's just so...
His voice trails off. He grins. Alcante's father was shaving when we arrived, with a painted shard of glass for a mirror, and a razor blade, and no soap or water. He finishes the job. Gradually, the rest of the family emerges from the hut, and I am reminded of the routine at the circus in which an apparently endless stream of people comes out of a tiny car. I estimate the hut to be about 10 feet by 20, and I count 10 souls who live in it. Farmer gazes at the hut. Well, I guess I don't need to do a house inspection. He stares at it some more. On a scale of 1 to 10, this is a 1. A long chat ensues. From it, Farmer draws a variety of lessons for me. Of the several cases of TB in this family, only the father's was detectable by sputum smear. That is, his was the only case that involved the lungs and was contagious. The only epidemiologically significant case. The only kind of case that Dots addresses. So, here's a house full of TB, where you only have 1 case, according to the Dots system, says Farmer. The rest had extrapulmonary disease, which doesn't count. It can kill you, but it doesn't count. He adds, and for a moment he is back in Peru, we never wanted to get rid of las normas. We just wanted to extend them and add some flexibility. There's also a socio-political lesson to draw, of course. Look at Alcante's family. It's intact, the kids are bright and clever, and the father can't walk, and they just can't make it. It's fucking unfair. The woman who said to me years ago, "Are you incapable of complexity?" That was an epiphany for me. Are you going to punish people for thinking TB comes from sorcery? It's like the guy on our own team, a nice guy, who said he would help with a water project in town here, but only if the people really showed they wanted it. What if that standard had been applied to me when I was a kid, before I knew that water could carry organisms that made people sick? He concludes the dismount saying, I'm glad we came, because now we know how grim it is, and we can intervene aggressively. I know what this means. A new house with a concrete floor and metal roof. Further arrangements for improving the family's nutrition, school tuition for the kids. Here's a good deed in progress, and a perfect example of the farmer method. First, you perform what he calls the distal intervention, and cure the family of TB. Then you start changing the conditions that made them especially vulnerable to TB in the first place. I'm aware of other voices that would praise a trip like this for its good intentions, and yet describe it as an example of what is wrong with Farmer's approach. Here's an influential anthropologist, medical diplomat, public health administrator, epidemiologist, who has helped to bring new resolve and hope to some of the world's most dreadful problems, and he's just spent 7 hours making house calls. How many desperate families live in Haiti? He's made this trip to visit 2. I think of the wealthy friend of Howard Hyatt's who balked at contributing to PIH because, while he knew about Farmer's work in Haiti and considered it impressive, he doubted anyone could reproduce it. I've heard variations on that theme. Farmer and Kim do things that no one else can do. Zomi La Santé won't survive Farmer. Partners in Health is an organization that relies too much on a genius. All the serious, sympathetic critiques come down to these 2 arguments. Hiking into the hills to see just 1 patient or 2 is a dumb way for Farmer to spend his time. And even if it weren't, not many other people will follow his example. Not enough to make much difference in the world. But standard notions of efficiency, notions about cost-effectiveness, about big people performing big jobs, haven't worked so well themselves. Long ago in North Carolina, Farmer watched the nuns doing menial chores on behalf of migrant laborers, and in the years since he's come to think that a willingness to do what he calls unglamorous scut work is the secret to successful projects in places like Cange and Caraballo. And, he says, another secret, a reluctance to do scut work is why a lot of my peers don't stick with this kind of work. In public health projects in difficult locales, theory often outruns practice. Individual patients get forgotten, and what seems like a small problem gets ignored, until it grows large, like MDR. If you focus on individual patients, Jim Kim says, you can't get sloppy. That approach has worked for PIH, and I can imagine Farmer saying he doesn't care if no one else is willing to follow their example. He's still going to make these hikes, he'd insist, because if you say that 7 hours is too long to walk for two families of patients, you're saying that their lives matter less than some others, and the idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that's wrong with the world. I think he undertakes what, earlier today, he called journeys to the sick, in part because he has to, in order to keep going. That's when I feel most alive, he told me once on an airplane, when I'm helping people. He makes these house calls regularly and usually without blanc witnesses, at times when no one from Harvard or WHO can see him kneeling on mud floors with his stethoscope plugged in. This matters to him, I think, to feel, at least occasionally, that he doctors in obscurity, so that he knows he doctors first of all because he believes it's the right thing to do. If you do the right thing well, you avoid futility. His patients tend to get better. They all get comforted. And he carries off, among other things, images of them and their medieval huts. These refresh his passion and authority, so that he can travel a quarter of a million miles a year and scheme and write about the health of populations. Doctoring is the ultimate source of his power, I think. His basic message is simple. This person is sick, and I am a doctor. Everyone, potentially, can understand and sympathize, since everyone knows or imagines sickness personally. And it can't be hard for most people to imagine what it would be like to have no doctor, no hope of medicine. I think Farmer taps into a universal anxiety, and also into a fundamental place in some troubled consciences, into what he calls ambivalence, the often unacknowledged uneasiness that some of the fortunate feel about their place in the world, the thing he once told me he designed his life to avoid. The best thing about Paul is those hikes, Ophelia says. You have to believe that small gestures matter, that they do add up. Earlier today, Farmer said that he'd brought on others to fight the long defeat. The numbers are impressive. They include priests and nuns and professors and secretaries and businessmen and church ladies and peasants like Tijan, and also dozens of medical students and doctors who have enlisted to work in such places as Kange and Siberia and the slums of Lima. Some of the students and doctors work for nothing. Some earn much less than they could elsewhere. Some raise their own salaries through grants. I once heard Farmer say that he hoped a day would come when he could do a good job just by showing up. It seems to me that time has already arrived. A great deal of what he started goes on without him now, in Roxbury and Tomsk and Peru and, some of the year, in Haiti. Meanwhile, other definitions than the usual of what can be done and what is reasonable to do in medicine and public health have spread from him. They're still spreading, like ripples in a pond. How does one person with great talents come to exert a force on the world? I think in Farmer's case the answer lies somewhere in the apparent craziness, the sheer impracticality of half of everything he does, including the hike to Kaas. We still have to get back to Zomilasanté. The sun is setting by the time we finally leave Alcante's family. Gray clouds billow over the mountains we crossed earlier today. The westering sun is rebuking us, says Farmer. He and Tijan confer. They decide we can't walk back the way we came, not across rivers and over steep paths in the dark without a flashlight. What they mean is, they don't think I'd make it. I'm not pleased that they think this, but am relieved that they do. We arrive back in Kaas around dusk. An old man rides down the dirt street on a horse, then a young man on a motorbike, whom Farmer stops. He asks the driver if he'll give one of our party, the pharmacist, a lift to Kange, and the young man says he will, but for $100. What's your name? Says Farmer in Creole.
Jackie, he replies.
Then he asks, Are you Dr. Paul?
Yes.
We know your machine eats gas, and we'll replace it. We brought some money for a family here, and they are living in squalor, unlike you, Jackie. And if you get sick, I won't ask you for $100. A little crowd has gathered to listen in. Now everyone, including Jackie, laughs. So it's settled. The pharmacist will ride with Jackie back to Cange and send a truck for Tijan and Farmer and me. Farmer didn't even break a sweat in the previous hours of walking, and now he feels like walking some more. Everyone thinks I'm unhealthy, he says to me. In fact, healthy as a horse. So we won't wait in Casse for the truck. Tijan and Farmer and I will walk along the dirt road that leads from Casse to Thomond, the route the truck will have to take. We stroll out of the village in fading light. The air is merely warm now, the kind of air that I'll remember on winter nights in northern places and think I must have dreamed. Soon, there being no electrical lights for miles and miles in any direction, the stars pop out en masse, bright enough, it seems, to faintly light the road. This is nice, Farmer says to me. A break from my clinic, from airplanes. I know your feet hurt, but I do in many ways prefer walking. A cozy feeling seems to spread from him. It's as if we're three kids out after bedtime, and we can say whatever is really on our minds, but don't have to. I sing a snatch of an army marching song. You had a good home, but you left. You had a nice bus, but you left, sings Farmer. Roosters crow in the night. Now and then a dog barks. Then we hear a strange sound coming toward us, like something scraping the road. What is it? Farmer asks Tijan. Tijan says, Job Baal. The literal translation is, its own job. He means, don't ask. In a moment, the shapes of a pair of men appear, dragging some sawn lumber down the road toward Casse. A few minutes later, we hear a squeaking sound approaching us. Farmer asks Tijan what it is, and Tijan answers more emphatically, Zafé Bundal, which means, its own ass. That is, he's telling Farmer to shut up and mind his own business. A moment later, the shape of a person on a squeaky old bicycle passes in the starlight. This continues. Another figure passes us, and Farmer says, Bonsoir, and Tijan shushes him, then issues these instructions. If someone passes you at night and doesn't speak, you too must remain silent. But if the person asks who you are, you must say, I am who you are. And if the person asks what you do, you must say, I do what you do. What's the danger? Farmer asks. Tijan says you might be talking to a demon who will steal your spirit. Then you'll wake up in the morning with diarrhea and vomiting, and the doctor will say you have typhoid or malaria, but in fact the problem will be more complex. You should take the medicines, says Tijan, but then you should also go to a voodoo priest. We stroll on. Farmer says that Tijan's discourse has reminded him of his first ardent explorations of Haiti and of the dozens of voodoo ceremonies he attended. Contrary to almost everything he'd read about their luridness, he found them long and boring. The majority were held because someone was sick. He asks Tijan his opinion. Are half of voodoo ceremonies attempts to drive away illness?
Three quarters, says Tijan.
Isn't it amazing, Farmer says to me, that this simple fact has eluded all the many commentaries on voodoo. We've walked 3 hours from Casse, 11 hours in all today, when I finally feel as though I can't go any farther. When I say so, Farmer calls a halt. I'm grateful that he doesn't tease me. We sit down on the side of the lumpy dirt road on the crest of a hill facing east. I have a candy bar, and we share it like a trio of Boy Scouts under the stars. Tijan points out a blinking red light far away, a radio tower across the border in the Dominican Republic. Staring at it, I hear Farmer's voice beside me, his gentle doctor's voice, asking how I feel. I tell him the truth, tired but feeling fine. And then, clear of all his duties for now, his last patient of the day attended to, he lies back on the ground and stares at the stars. There's Orion's belt. From somewhere in the valley below us comes the sound of drums. I recall the time I spent here in the Central Plateau with the American soldiers, and I remember the sound of voodoo drums wafting into the army barracks in Mir Balay at night, and how unsettling it was to some of us sitting there in all its mystery. I'm sure we'd have felt different if we'd known we were probably hearing ceremonies to cure the sick. For myself, right now, I like the sound. Like so many hearts beating through a single stethoscope. Afterward. In June 2002, 7 years after the death of Father Jacques Roussin, WHO adopted new prescriptions for dealing with MDR-TB, virtually the same as PIH had used in Caraballo. For Jim Kim, this marked the end of a long campaign. The world changed yesterday, he wrote from Geneva to all of PIH. The prices of second-line antibiotics continued to decline, and the drugs now flowed fairly smoothly through the Green Light Committee to, among other places, Peru, where about 1,000 chronic patients were either cured or in treatment. About 250 were receiving the drugs in Tomsk, and largely because of the efforts of WHO, the Russian Ministry of Health had finally agreed to the terms of the World Bank's TB loan, $150 million, to begin to fight the epidemic throughout the country. The twin pandemics of AIDS and tuberculosis raged on, of course, magnifying each other, in Africa and Asia, Eastern Europe and Latin America. Mathematical models predicted widening global catastrophe, 100 million HIV infections in the world by the year 2010. Some prominent voices, some in the U.S. government, still argued that AIDS could not be treated in desperately impoverished places. But this view seemed to be fading. The prices of antiretrovirals were falling, even more dramatically than the prices of second-line TB drugs. This was thanks to a growing worldwide campaign for treating AIDS wherever it occurred. Jim Kim had often said that the world's response to AIDS and TB would define the moral standing of his generation. In 2003, a new director general took over at WHO, and he asked Jim to serve as his senior advisor. Meanwhile, the example of Zami La Santé was growing, and Kanj had become a favorite destination for global health policymakers and American politicians. The Global Fund money was delayed, as such monies often are, but Farmer chose not to wait, and in the summer of 2002, the expansion of Zami La Santé began, the expansion of the entire system, including antiretroviral treatment throughout the Central Plateau. To pay the bills until the Global Fund money arrived, PIH borrowed $2 million from a commercial bank in Boston. Tom White guaranteed the loan and soon paid off a part of it. And the PIH employees with the highest salaries took care of interest payments on the rest. In essence, Farmer's plan was to beef up the health facilities in the Central Plateau. First of all, in towns near Kanj. He dispatched teams of Haitian and American doctors and technicians to three towns. One team went to a settlement called Las Cahobas, some miles north of Kanj. When they arrived, they found a wretched, nearly empty private hospital and a nearly empty public clinic, which had almost no drugs on hand, unreliable electrical power for a few hours a day, and a staff of one doctor and five nurses who all went home for good at 1 p.m. Serena Koenig, a member of the Las Cahobas team, described the situation as a nightmare. But by October, after a month of beefing up, that clinic had a generator, a lab, a full supply of medicines, and doctors on hand all day. And the place was packed with patients, about 200 daily, sometimes 300. The decline in foreign aid to Haiti and to the Haitian government continued, and so did the flood of patients to Cange. But not many came from Las Cahobas anymore. The passenger truck from there to Zomi-La-Santé, which used to be completely filled, had stopped making the run for lack of riders. Haiti was still bleeding away, like its topsoil. The whole situation was rotten, Farmer wrote. He added, but there are some spots of hope. With help from T. Fifi, a group of Cangeois had drafted a petition to President Aristide asking for electricity. By late October, pylons were being erected to carry power from the dam at Peligue to Cange for a few hours a day. And the Red Cross had announced plans to establish a transfusion post at Zomi-La-Santé. Nearly 20 years since Farmer had watched a woman die in Léogan for lack of a transfusion, and he finally had a blood bank that could serve the Central Plateau, a source of blood that patients wouldn't have to pay for. No more weeping over blood, he wrote to me. Some of his emails were ebullient. We're growing by leaps and bounds. Zomi-La-Santé's staff now included more than 200 community health workers, about a dozen nurses, and 12 doctors, among them a Cuban surgeon and a Cuban pediatrician. They were caring for more than 3,000 HIV patients and providing antiretrovirals to about 350. They now had the equipment and trained personnel to do some of their own high-tech AIDS diagnostics. Meanwhile, Père Lafontaine had managed the construction of a second operating room. Also in 2002, Cange saw its first open-heart surgeries, performed by teams from the Brigham and South Carolina. I felt tempted to ask Farmer if this was appropriate technology. Not to hear the answer, just to hear him say it. This concludes the reading of Mountains Beyond Mountains by Tracy Kidder. Copyright 2003 by Tracy Kidder. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in 2003 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Paul Michael. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package, or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.